Professor Fareed Esak is a South African Muslim theologian, currently the Bloomberg Fellow at Harvard Divinity School. As an activist in the religious solidarity movement for justice and peace during the struggle against apartheid, he played a leading role in the United Democratic Front, the Call of Islam, the Organization of People Against Sexism, and the World Conference on Religion and Peace. Professor Esak will be speaking about lessons from South Africa's anti-apartheid movement, implications for the Israeli-Palestinian struggle.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the gracious, the dispenser of grace. That's a reminder to me, thank you very much, a reminder to me to switch off my mobile phone. Do you think it was also a reminder to you? I needed to change the nature of my visa for the United States for this current trip, and it took a bit of a while. I was meant to be here a couple of days ago. I was hoping to attend the Islamic Society's National Association's conference as well. Anyway, so I went to the American Embassy. After I got my papers, I went to the American Embassy, and I was going to fill in the forms for my visa. I drove up there, saw that there wasn't any parking in the very vast and expansive parking lot. They've got a new embassy now that is on a bit of a hill, and it's also next to Portsmouth Prison, the prison where Nelson Mandela was kept in for very many years. But it's a very attractive building, I dare say, and it's on a bit of a hill. From a security angle, an excellent choice. So when I tried to find parking, I couldn't find parking anywhere near the building. So I parked in front of what was clearly to me a disused entrance of a primary school outside the embassy. But on the other side of the embassy, not on embassy property. So then I joined the row of petitioners, humbled petitioners, in old India, Pakistan, you would sign your letters, you know, this humble petitioner. So this humble petitioner joined the row of people applying for visas. Then somebody came to me and said that I needed to move my car. So I said, why? So he said, no, you needed to move your car. So I said, no, I'm not moving my car. My car is not parked on your property. This is your property. That is the road. The car is parked on the other side of the road. So he came back with his senior, who told me in no uncertain terms that if I don't park, that the security at the door would be instructed to never let me in. And so I will just not get in for my visa if I do not move my car. I had a similar argument with this person, and then they called another senior person. The senior person took a while to come out, and then came up, and he was better. And said that, look, sir, I do understand that you don't want to park, that you insist on parking there. That's fine, that's your choice. But I do want to tell you that these people across the road, it's a school, that they are our neighbors. And we're trying to be good neighbors. And if you park your car there, it doesn't contribute to good neighborliness. At which point I began to succumb, rational, decent, moderate, well-speaking, moderate Muslim. So I asked him, where shall I park? Said that I could park at Pick and Pay. Now, Pick and Pay is a bit like our Walmart, you know. That I could park at Pick and Pay, and he waved to where Pick and Pay was. The walk from the Pick and Pay parking lot to the embassy was about 10 minutes. So I had to walk 10 minutes from the embassy. But I also told him that I'm not a customer of Pick and Pay's. Why should I go to Pick and Pay? So he said, no, Pick and Pay knows about the arrangement. So a few things. The one was, the first language that we use is a language of power. If you don't do what we want you to do, we will not give you access. We know that you are in need of us, but you and your needs can go to hell. Our security needs and how we write our security needs, that is the most important thing. When you don't understand the language of harshness, of coercion, then we have softer language for you. Good neighborliness. And so we can have the language of democracy for you. We can have the language of moderation, the language of pluralism for you. But the language of moderation and pluralism and niceness and good neighborliness, these are mere substitutes. These are camouflages for the real language. The real language is just one of control. It is one of control. It is one of power. It is about our own security and to hell with how far other people have to walk. And of course, there was also the other coded message of the relationship between the United States Embassy and Pick and Pay. Pick and Pay is this large Walmart, and they were clearly in some kind of an arrangement, possibly also hoping that the customers, visa petitioners, after their long walk from the embassy, may be hungry and thirsty and would make good customers for Pick and Pay. But I saw a very interesting interlocking of relationship between the different forms of power in this whole visa story, but also how messages on messages on terror and so on are promoted and sold. I'm here tonight to talk to you about Palestine, about South Africa. What do I, as a South African, make of it? One of the things that strikes me when I visit the land of Palestine and Israel, let me first say something about myself. I am South African. I've lived in South Africa all my life, all my childhood. I did not grow up with Palestine as an important part of my imagination or my political consciousness. There was a particular event that many of us remember, and we were alerted to it again, for many people in very uncomfortable ways, 2 or 3 weeks ago, when Leila Khalid came to visit South Africa. And Leila Khalid had been a plane hijacker 30 years ago. She was jailed, freed from jail in some prisoner exchange story, had undergone facial surgery, and then committed a second bombing. And I'm starting off with this slightly startling bit of news for people. And then Leila came to South Africa a month ago, and this woman, who was a terrorist, blew up two plane bombs. You may not like this. She came to South Africa where she was much celebrated. People in their thousands turned out to meet Leila Khalid. Our cabinet ministers met Leila Khalid. Leila visited parliament. Mandela came out to visit Khalid. Many parents wanted to introduce their children to her. Many, many people had named their children Leila. And so I also grew up with the awareness of Leila Khalid. At a particular time in our history. From the time that I was very young, I was always deeply troubled by manifestations of injustices that I saw around me. I was 12 years old when I had my first encounter with the security police. They came to get me at school. And that was a time when it wasn't fashionable for kids to be arrested, for kids to be detained without trial. I remember the name of the person. It was Spaker and Andries, Spaker and his brothers. Later, they became characters of much notoriety in South Africa's torture annals. And one of the sad things, of course, about South Africa was that children were never allowed to be children. From very, very young ages, we saw how our parents were humiliated in front of us. I was the son of a single mother. My father left our family when he was 3 weeks old. And under the Group Areas Act, the area that we were lived in was declared white. It was declared white, and the bulldozers came, flattened our homes. Our homes weren't nice, but they were our homes. Flattened our homes, and we were thrown literally into the middle of nowhere. We're the only kind of trees that grow were Port Jackson trees. And those Port Jackson trees were later exported to Saudi Arabia because they found that it could grow in the desert. But nothing else besides those Port Jackson trees grew. And so there we were in Bonteville, a wasteland. And you throw in people from settled communities, different settled communities, you throw them into this place. There is this enormous displacement that takes place. And so nobody speaks about it. None of my family's ever spoken about it except I. But one night there was drama. My mother came running into the home and she screamed. My brothers all ran out of the house into the darkness, came back much later. There was lots of noise and commotion. There was police. We weren't allowed to ask what had happened. Until now, we're not allowed to ask what had happened. My mother was raped. And this is, of course, the double rape of women. The actual rape and then the rape of silence, that they're not allowed to speak about the expression. They're not allowed to speak about their trauma. And this was in the township. It was a place that we called from Kansi to Kansi, where men and women leave early in the morning when it is dark and they return late at night when it is dark, where they cook tonight for tomorrow, where the only time that they can rest is on a Sunday afternoon, but resting the body not so much from the hard work of the last week, but in preparation, in anticipation of the hard work for the next. She was only 50 years old, God bless her soul, when she dropped dead on the factory floor of a heart attack. Quite literally, the victim of the triple oppression of women, patriarchy, apartheid, and class. And I had an abiding, I was a kid. I was a kid when she died. But my mother's death and the wrongful nature of this death and the wrongful nature of her existence, this woman, a victim of men all around her, something is missing. This cannot be God's plan for people. It cannot be God's plan for the world, that one woman ought to have her life controlled by six sons, by white bureaucrats, who sign off where you live and where you can't live, and by a factory boss, a man, a woman whose lives overwhelmed by men who have the power over women of life and death, who rape and then ascribe silence to the act that they did, so that the victim becomes doubly victimized, and the criminal emerges as a hero, unblemished. And so these were some of the things that formed my earliest understanding of right and wrong in the world. And since then, and it's not always successfully, I've always struggled. But before I come to, but in the middle of this madness, the madness of township life, of ghetto life, the madness of violence, in the middle of all of this, I was always desperate to find the presence of God. You know, in the township, there are two gods that really help you survive this. The one is the God of the mafia, and the other is your God. But, you know, in the gangs, they also call the leaders gods. And so it's one of this, you opt for this God or you opt for that God. I opted for the transcendent God. And struggling then all the time, this transcendent God kept me alive, kept me going, kept me sane. But I was never going to leave this transcendent God alone. I wanted to know, how do you relate to all the pain and suffering that I see around me? So when today I am asked, why do you single out Israel? It's often now regarded as a badge of anti-Semitism to be singling out Israel. It's your problem if you think you're being singled out. I have a lifetime of fighting against gender injustice. I have a lifetime of fighting against racial injustice, of fighting for environmental justice. The last 4 or 5 years, 5 or 6 years ago, I founded an organization called Positive Muslims, working on issues of discrimination against people living with HIV and AIDS, the new front line, the new battle in Southern Africa. And so we have many, many battles. The struggle for justice and peace in the Middle East. No particular bee in my bonnet about Jews. No particular affection for the Israelis. No particular disdain for the Israelis. No particular affection for the Palestinians either. Quite simple. That yearning started off so early in my South African experiences compels me to recognize injustice wherever I see it. And so upon visiting the land of Palestine and Israel, one is always struck by the separateness, the apartness of existences, even as the lives of the inhabitants, the Palestinians and the Jews, are so inexorably intertwined. It is possible to traverse large sections of the land and never encounter somebody from the other side, except perhaps, as for the Palestinians who regularly encounter the other, as a soldier, a policeman or a security guard protecting the bulldozers. It is possible to have one's shop right next to one belonging to the other in such close proximity as found only in the Middle East, souk, like one does in the market of the old city of Jerusalem, and never really encounter the other. I know of an Israeli Jew born of Iraqi parents. He lived his entire life in Israel. Yet, he first met an ordinary Palestinian at the age of 40 years old. Like the vast majority of other Israeli Jews, he had until then encountered them only in the context of eating in their restaurants or having them clean Israeli streets. He met an ordinary Palestinian in the course of his business as vice president of a large Israeli communications company, and they met to discuss the prospects of having a satellite TV in Palestine. Afterwards, he told his brother-in-law how impressed he was by the fact that the Palestinian was actually well-dressed and looked like a normal businessman. And he told so with a childlike surprise to see a clean, well-dressed Arab who could speak to him in regular business language. Now, I too grew up in a world of separateness. General Ami Ayalon, former chief of Israel's domestic intelligence agency, said, "I do not like the word separation. It reminds me too much of apartheid South Africa." But then, words often cloud reality, and this is sometimes painful. It is then that we use words which are easy on our conscience, particularly if the conscience itself is light, as in Coke Light or Marlboro Light. I shall return to the subject of words as a weapon of deceit and delusion later. For now, suffice to say that they often prevent us from seeing ourselves as we really are, and then stunt our freedom to be who we can possibly be. So perhaps, more than the word separation, I must flee from separation itself. Greater than the determination to dodge accusations of sexism should be the commitment to uncover sexism in my life and to work against it. And so this is a strange place. Here in the Holy Land, Separateness is valorized by decent people and presented as the peace option. And the not so nice ones openly preach ethnic cleansing. Yet those who preach ethnic cleansing are often viewed as persons that we can do business with. Of course, it depends a bit on who we are and the nature of the business. In South Africa, apartheid was regarded by the world as a problem. Here in Israel and in much of the world, it is presented as a solution. For many otherwise decent people who do not experience dispossession and discrimination on a daily basis, stability in its preferred and somehow morally elevated package as peace becomes the single most important objective for which one must yearn for. And so we talk about, we support the peace process, and this becomes a mantra for all decent people. Yet a refusal to connect with other people can sometimes be part of a broader struggle to ensure that when connectedness happens, it is a just one, that niceness and peace do not become nominal substitutes for the substance of justice and integrity. Wouldn't it be nice if that woman stopped embarrassing her husband by screaming out so loud when she is being beaten? Why can't she just get on with the business of being a good mother? Will someone please pacify her? Questions such as whom do we connect with and to what end and whose peace are important to consider if we do not want to be taken for a ride, unless, of course, we do want to be taken for a ride. Now, as I said, I've traveled to Palestine, Israel, 5 or 6 times in the last 15 years, and I've also been a part of this apartness. Whenever I arrive in Tel Aviv airport, I invariably hasten to get to the parts of Jerusalem still inhabited by the Palestinians, desperate to avoid spending a single shekel more than absolutely necessary in contributing to the Israeli economy. Often, also because I'm afraid of the Israeli other and keen to create a huge distance between myself and the security officers at the airport who start the interrogation from the moment that I put foot on the ground. At least an illusion of a distance, because I don't think one ever shakes them off completely. I'm also aware that by coming here, I have made a political choice. I come from a country where we called upon the conscience of the world to stay away from it, where we expected all decent people to heed the call for economic, academic, cultural sanctions against South Africa. Chief Albert Luthuli, one of the great fathers of our nation and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, appealed to the world as early as 1960. We welcome most heartily the action of the overseas people in launching the boycott. Our hope really is this, that we can bring pressure to bear on South Africa, and that through this pressure, South Africa will change its way of dealing with non-Europeans. We must pursue our policy of non-violence up to a limit. We therefore must welcome your decision to boycott, as we are convinced that nothing but good can flow out of all our efforts directed against defeating a policy which seeks to perpetuate Afrikaner domination and economic exploitation of the millions of African people. So despite the call for sanctions, some people still came to South Africa, investors and tourists, some of them probably nice folk, they still came, claiming innocence and being apolitical. And we South Africans, we despised them. They came at the invitation of white South Africa. They had the money and the freedom to do with it as they pleased. The white-dominated economy of South Africa needed their money as much as the pimps in some other countries need the sex tourists. Now, many of these tourists returned to their homes, not surprisingly enchanted with what our country had to offer and ignorant of any reality beyond the bodies that smiled at them and satisfied them. Oh, I've been to South Africa myself. And don't be fooled by all this communist propaganda. The blacks are really very happy there. This was the kind of stuff that people came back with. Now, apartness is not unique to Palestine or to Israel, as any churchgoer in the United States can testify. Even in the post-apartheid South Africa, the vast majority of whites have never been to a colored or a black township.
and most coloureds and Indians have never been in a black one. But when apartness is elevated to dogma and ideology, and when it is enforced through the law and its agencies, then it is ultimately what apartheid is. Then we are dealing with something particularly horrific, no matter how genuine the trauma that gave birth to it, and regardless of the religious depth of the exclusivist claims underpinning it. And how we respond to our own trauma and the indifference of the world, indeed, the world's culpability, even if only by its silence towards our trauma, never justified traumatizing others or our indifference to the trauma of others. Apartness, then, not only becomes a sound foundation for ignorance of the other with whom one shares a common space, but apartness also becomes the basis for denying the suffering and the humiliation that the other undergoes as a consequence of our own rather expansive approach to being in the world. The Nazis, in the wake of the humiliating conditions imposed upon them by the Treaty of Versailles, described this as Lebensraum, expanding your living space. Now, for a South African, there is a sense of deja vu, an inescapable sense of deja vu. Immediately upon arriving in the land of Palestine and Israel, let me rephrase that. For a South African who has lived or just survived under apartheid, or who acted in solidarity with those who did, it's a fairly simple matter made out to be struck by this enforced separation. In some ways, all of us are the children of our history, the relevance of our own stories, and sadly, the irrelevance of the stories of others. Yet, we also choose to be struck by the stories of others. And perhaps this ability to be struck by the stories of others, this is really the barometer of our humanness. To get upset at your own injuries. I was telling Brian this afternoon, you know, when we say, "Thou shalt not kill," we say, "No, thou shalt not kill me." It is about us. So to be struck by your own stories, to go in defense of your own hurt, to say never again to your own hurt, it's an important task if you had been hurt. But far more important is never again to the hurt of everybody and the acknowledgement that an injury to one is an injury to all. That if I say yes to you being hurt, I am detracting from my own humanity. I cannot be a full human being when I stand by and I see somebody spitting on you. And so when I stand up and rise in defense of people languishing in Guantanamo Bay, people being shelled, I'm standing up and I'm rising in my own defense. Postmodernists, thinkers, feminists, liberation theologians, and others have long since debunked the idea of objectivity and have insisted on disclosure as a precondition for dialogue. Tell us about your class, your gender, your interests. What are the lenses with which you view the world? In the words of David Tracy, the famous Roman Catholic theologian, there is no historyless, discourseless human being. A denial of lenses is really tantamount to the acceptance of the dominant status quo. And so, I don't want to pretend that I am objective in all of this. I come to Israel with my South African baggage. My South African baggage gives me enormous currency. And we were chatting about this earlier on also. Some of the just currency, some of it well earned, but I need to be careful about how I spend it also. We have earned this currency through our engagement in a liberation struggle. The value of this currency went up enormously by the creation of a constitution that outlawed discrimination against women, against gay people, against religious people, all of the wonderfulness, the pluralism, the rainbow nature of our country manifested in the life and struggle of somebody like Nelson Mandela and so on. And so our pockets are filled. Our pockets are filled with the currency of legitimacy of the liberation struggle. our pockets are filled with the currency of having successfully pulled it off after the liberation struggle. And we need to share some of this currency with people in other parts of the world. But filled pockets can always lead to a kind of arrogance. And so there are, in fact, new layers of a South African arrogance that is also emerging in the world. But more about that possibly later. But for now, I want to talk about about how to look at things. And how, through what eyes am I then looking at this, my South African eyes. Two things that goes into it. My history as somebody oppressed and in the liberation struggle. And by the way, I played the leading role in leading Muslims in the liberation struggle in the 70s and in the early 90s. So when I walk through the districts where sex is on sale, I can choose to see it through the eyes of the sex tourist or through the eyes of the sex worker who is sold into trade or driven by their poverty and exploitation into it. And so I choose to look at Palestine through the eyes of the marginalized and exploited. And I choose to privilege this perspective over other perspectives. So is it sex tourism or is it sexual exploitation? Or worse, is it a refusal to name it and a preference to speak about the seemingly neutral, just having some fun or relaxation? Some people say, oh, I'm going to, what is this place in Thailand? Putak? Don't worry, you're not going to be exposing yourself. You're not going to be exposing yourself. But what a place in Thailand very famous for sex work. Phuket, yes. She's only sounding kind of very well, I'm not sure. She's very, very sure, man. No, it is Phuket, yes, Phuket. So I'm going to Phuket for some relaxation. I'm going to Phuket for R&R. It's a military term, rest and recreation for R&R. No, you don't say I'm going to go to Phuket for sex work. You don't say I'm going for exploitation of sex workers. And this is how we camouflage and try to keep our decent selves, you know, in some kind of decent shape when it's really being rotten by the inside by the use of our words. I'm astonished at how ordinary, decent people whose hearts are in the right place equivocate when it comes to Israel and the dispossession and sufferings of the Palestinians. And yet I wonder about the nature of decency. Do objectivity, moderation, and both sides not have context? Is moderation in matters of manifest injustice really a virtue? Do both parties deserve an equal hearing in a situation of domestic violence where a woman gets beaten up by a male, but this male was abused by his father some years ago because he too is a victim? He was abused by his father some years ago. He's now abusing his wife. You enter in from the outside and you say, wait, I can't deal with this man now. I see that he is abusing his wife because he's also a victim of abuse. He was abused by his father. What role did this wife have in the abuse of this man by her father? As somebody who has embraced this man as a husband, she may have some responsibility in working with him through his abuse. But when I see this, there's an immediate thing that has to be done. This man's abuse has to stop. Regardless of where he's abused, and regardless of the legitimacy of his or her own pain. When we reduce the problem to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or worse, the Israeli-Arab conflict, as if the Palestinians aren't a people, or the Middle East situation, what does it really say about us, our own power interest, and our refusal to have our own comfort zones disturbed? To describe violence against women as just that risks alienating the male partner. So don't call it violence against women. Say they had a domestic squabble. The woman is covered in blue. The woman is covered in blood. And you say they had a minor kerfuffle. Or you say that, some issues that needs to be sorted out between them. If that abusive male is also our business partner, or possibly one's own boss, or one's primary funder, then things can get really sticky. So we walk away saying, I don't want to get into the middle of all of this. Or we delude ourselves with seemingly conciliatory mutterings without ever addressing the question of abuse. Friends, we are in the middle of it because we do business with the abusive husband, and or we profit from his abuse of his wife, and we sustain his illusions that he's okay. A part of the civilized world, we seek refuge in both sides have a story to tell as a way of dodging our own complicity. Rather than us merely hallowing the abuser with a mantle of respectability, our silence draws us into a web of complicity, as indeed can be the effect of an uncritical solidarity with the victims of oppression. However small minority they may have been, only those who have refused to turn a blind eye to the persecution of the Jews by the Nazis were civilized. Only those who refused to be silent were civilized. All others had Jewish blood on their hands. Talking about the Jewish-German conflict, or the black-white situation, or marital problems in the face of manifest injustice and domestic abuse is no great virtue. It is the path of initially acquiescence and ultimately complicity. A curious phenomenon among so many liberals who are also supporters of Zionism or apologists for Israel is the inability or refusal to see how conservatives or Republicans can get nothing right except Israel. They hate George Bush and every single of his policies with an abiding passion, and they still believe he has it right with Israel. Others are simply too intelligent, too sensitive, too aware to not get it right. A few years ago, I taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York, a citadel of Christian progressive thinking, where often one gets the impression that heterosexual males go on their knees every morning to confess the sin of ontological sexual status before God or the goddess. That's politically correct, political correctness for you. Students there and faculty embrace the cause of every conceivable marginalized group on the face of the earth. 2 hours after the first of the two towers came down on the 2nd of September, a student at a service in the chapel asked worshippers to, and I quote, never forget that those towers themselves represented a horrible form of economic terrorism against the people of the third world. In utter discourse, though, the faculty and staff here, Palestine and the Palestinians, may well be a place in outer space. I recently had a long conversation with a colleague, a well-known scholar of liberation theology, and I inquired about his inability to connect the dots. No, he does connect the dots. He does see where Palestine fits into Pax Americana and the war on the empire and. And he often shares his views with his wife. In listening to my friend, I somehow had the image of an adult watching a child playing connecting the dots. As in most of these puzzles for toddlers, the picture is fairly obvious. The child sees, the adult sees the child making pencil scribblings all over the page without touching the dot and quickly walks away, afraid of losing the child's friendship by alerting the child to the picture obscured by the dot. The picture is not a nice one. It is in fact one of a seemingly innocent child as a monster. The adult wants to continue viewing the child as innocent, in large part because the adult was responsible for the child having turned into a monster. I asked my colleague about his silence, and he said something about wanting to keep the conversations going, a conversation which does not ever include the plight of the Palestinians, and of not wanting to alienate friends. Perhaps it is about this. It is also about us already being alienated from a principled commitment to justice. Whose story are we really tuned into, and whose interests do we serve by turning into the side that we do, or by opting for an illusionary neutrality? To work with abusers is indeed a noble task. In some ways, the problem of abuse can only be addressed by working with abusers as human beings with all the potential to be fully human. Now, the Jewish people have been subjected to enormous trauma over the century, and it is inhuman, callous, to ignore this. It is equally inhuman to pretend that this did not leave any scars on them. How does the world, including the many Jews who have worked through this pain, intervene to prevent disastrous behavior, often born in genuine insecurity, which destroys the rights of others who were largely unrelated to that earlier trauma? In the words of Liat Weingart, a young Jewish Voice for Peace activist, we need people to interrupt our cycles of destruction. Thus, we can and should be in solidarity with Jews, as we were with white South Africans, but only as part of a broader struggle for the liberation of all victims of dehumanization and a struggle for the humanization of all people. So then the last one, can we compare Palestine, the Palestinian situation, to apartheid? When there is this post hoc universal recognition that a particular ideology was evil, then it is understandable that no one, well, at least no one respectable, welcomes having his or her ideology or worldview compared to this. This is why we have seen so few people admitting that they ever supported Nazism, and why just about everyone in South Africa today claims to have been a part of the liberation struggle. Nothing quite succeeds like success. I mean, gosh, it is just amazing, you know. You find, I go to Europe, and the European Solidarity Movement people think that they were the ones who ended apartheid. I come to America, and I speak to black Americans especially, and they talk to me, and they really talk as if it is them and their anti-sanctions and their sanctions thing that ended, that freed Mandela. Everybody, I was the one who made it. And none of us, Dick Cheney probably gone quiet about the comment that he made 6 months before Mandela was released, that Mandela is a terrorist and must stay there. 6 months before Mandela was released, that was his line still. But now nobody speaks about this. Nobody speaks about how we were anti-divestment, how we thought, oh, only the blacks will be harmed by this and so on. No, no, no. It's like this civil rights thing in your country. Every city now, it is respectable to have a Martin Luther King stadium or boulevard in every city. It's good for the city. It's good, even may help you to stave off doing anything real about racism in the city. Get your Martin Luther King Boulevard. Make sure that you have a Jewish Holocaust Museum. Very, very important also. If you have a Jewish Holocaust Museum, you don't have to address underlying issues of anti-Semitism and how the Jews in private company are still seen as this or as that and so on. So have your anti-Holocaust Museum, you know. And so Mandela is now welcomed as everybody's grandfather, everybody's uncle, kind of, this old man that needs to be hugged and cuddled and so on, if only I can pose for a photo with him. Yeah, but these are all post hoc things. These are all rationalizations. For a moment I thought. Yeah. A persistent characteristic of all Palestinians and those acting in solidarity with them and their struggle have been attempts to make connections with South Africa under apartheid. More commonly, people are talking about Israeli apartheid. People spoke about the Bantustans, these homelands that they have created in Israel. And these terms have been employed for various options. More recently, the term apartheid wall is also being used for the 8-meter barrier being currently constructed in the West Bank in defiance of the International Court of Justice, which, by the way, has declared such construction illegal. The similarities between Zionism and apartheid are constantly highlighted in order to awaken the conscience of the world to the fact that identical developments are supposedly taking place in Palestine, and that this is meant to galvanize the world, that had galvanized the world against apartheid. Furthermore, given the confusion which often characterizes both the nature of the conflict as well as the Palestinians' leadership response to it, Many activists feel a need to latch onto a struggle that was seemingly clear-cut and free from any complexities, which paralyzes the international community, which would prevent them from hiding behind uncertainties. Like, you know, I traveled a lot in the anti-apartheid movement, and I was always astounded by people who kept on telling me, yes, but it's a very complex situation, isn't it? It's complex. And then they would talk about this black-on-black violence. And they would talk about the necklace killings. That became a big one, the necklace killings. And it was just amazing. I came from South Africa, the ANC. We did not see these complexities. And I really believe that people use these complexities as part of their medicine to lullaby them into not doing anything. People are good. You don't want to do anything, but you want to feel good about not doing anything. So you take the tablet of complexity. You say it is complex. If you say it is complex, it gives you an error, an aura of being a thinking person. The problem is complex. So you are a thinking person. You are a decent person because you don't want to act hastily and foolishly and then have egg on your face. Really, friends, I tell you, I smelt all the time when I encountered this. I smelt only two things. I smelt cowardice, and I smelt at heart, really, a quiet desire that the status quo must continue as it is, and that the suffering of black people did not really matter. This was what the discourse of complexity hid. Furthermore, and so we say, the situation is rather complex. It's a rather readily available rationalization for inertia and even cowardice. Consider this analogy. A group of well-meaning activists in the late 1850s, America, hoped to bring an end to the horrors of slavery without war. They proposed that the two sides strive for reconciliation. The slaves sit down at the negotiating table with slave owners and attempt to work out their differences through negotiation. The activists believe that the institution of slavery is oppressive, a violation of human rights, and that it must end. But they also recognize the property rights of the owners to their slaves, as well as the owners' right to their lives and their livelihoods, their right to exist and not to be murdered in a slave uprising. The activists propose a middle way between the two sides, recognizing that both are responsible for the conflict. Slaves have shown a propensity to rebel, causing the slave owners to tighten their oppressive grip, but believing that both slave and owners have a right to be free, peaceful and secure lives, and that it is the only way to achieve this is to avoid blaming either side. So let's not blame. I'm a South African. This enforced separation that I see in Palestine comes very easily to me. Every single South African that have participated in this struggle have recognized this. Among the veterans of our country's liberation struggle, the question is not whether the situation is really comparable to apartheid or not. Rather, it is this. Is anything that blacks experience under apartheid akin to the oppression and suffering endured by the Palestinians? We really believe that nothing that we experience under apartheid is akin to what the Palestinians are experiencing. And I'm talking as somebody that has been there five times. Nelson Mandela has said this. Desmond Tutu has said this. Ronnie Castles has said this. The leaders of our trade unions have said this. So it is quite simple. We want people to listen to our experiences, listen to our observations. It's not for you to say, I mean, whether it's true or not. This is what we are saying, that our experience, every single South African who cut his or her teeth in the liberation struggle have come back saying this, that no, the logic of apartheid is akin to the logic of Zionism. The reality of Zionism is far worse than the reality of apartheid for us in South Africa. And so based on this, I say that whatever comparisons with in Israel proper or in the Orthodox in the occupied territories with apartheid, life for the Palestinians is infinitely worse than what we had ever experienced under apartheid, and the price that they've had to pay for resistance much more horrendous. The second question is this. Do South Africans who have lived and suffered under apartheid recognize the existence of Palestinians as akin to theirs under apartheid? And do they see the struggle of Palestinians for freedom and dignity as similar to the one that they had also undertaken? To this question, there's an undeniable yes, unless one wishes to argue that people such as Mandela and Tutu are uninformed about apartheid. Tutu, who is also, by the way, the chief patron of South Africa's Holocaust Museum, speaks about how witnessing the conditions of the Palestinians reminded me so much of what happened to us as black people in South Africa. I say, why are our memories so short? Have our Jewish brothers and sisters forgotten their humiliation? While I write as someone who has lived under apartheid, and as someone that believes that they are subjected to much brutal forms of injustice, and this has been echoed by a number of others, and as numerous others choose to visit Israel, will only see it through the eyes of other Westerners, other Zionists, or tourist guide, I went to see it through my South African eyes, the eyes of a veteran of our country's liberation struggle. Israel had for long been an ally of the apartheid regime, at a time when the regime had only two or three other allies in the world, at a time when the conscience of the world had turned its back into South Africa. My first visit during the beginning of the First Intifada in 1988, when our own liberation struggle had reached new heights. As someone deeply involved in that struggle, it was very difficult for me to look at the state of Israel through benign eyes. It was very difficult. Here was a country founded in response to many impulses, including a response to the savagery of Nazism, which was now arming an unapologetically racist South African regime that supported the Nazis to the hilt. So, South African regime supported the Nazis to the hilt. Many of the government officials that came to power in 1948, when the apartheid regime first came to power formally, many of them were imprisoned as terrorists just before that by the United Party government for their terrorism work on the side of the Nazis. So when they came to power, this other state that came to power as a result of Nazi oppression, that state becomes the chief ally of this other Nazi state. And now we're living in a period when Nelson Mandela is everybody's favorite uncle. It is all too convenient to forget Israel's support for the apartheid regime. Here I was in a country that had turned its unique preferential trade privileges with both the United States and European Economic Community into a springboard for world markets for South African goods. As late as 1976, at a time when the brutal repression of the uprisings in Soweto and elsewhere in South Africa brought a new sense of urgency to the isolation of the apartheid regime, Israel signed a series of agreements with it for an accelerated level of military, technological, and economic cooperation. This cooperation was rather embarrassing for many of Israel's more liberal friends, supporters in Europe and the United States. But like most embarrassments, it was largely ignored when the slightest whiff of normality came about. The great pretense that had never happened set in. But for those at the receiving ends of these arms and weapons, as an axis of evil, it was admittedly rather difficult to just shrug it off. It was only on my fourth or fifth visit, well after the end of apartheid, when I first ventured, I shouldn't be going on and on like this. I should be stopping in the next 5 minutes. It was only on my fourth or fifth visit, well after the end of apartheid, when I first ventured into the western part of Jerusalem to meet with some organizations working on issues of gender justice. And yes, I went to Yad Vashem. Here, donning a paper kippah, I wept freely at the memory of the millions of Jews and others being killed during the Holocaust, at the invective that I had recently heard being spouted by an Egyptian preacher, Muhammad Kishk. The Jews, watch out for the Jews. I wept at the hatred that I saw being spewed at an ahistorical, the Jew, during the 8 years of my theological training in Pakistan, at the capacity of man, yes, of man, to inflict suffering on humankind, at the inability of the planners of this memorial to spare a candle for the many gypsies and homosexuals also killed by the Nazis, and for the tragedy of the Palestinian people, whom Edward Said has so aptly described as the victims of the victims, who now have to endure dispossession because of the unspeakable crimes that some white people committed against other white people. I recall the slogan from the days of the liberation struggle, an injury to one is an injury to all. And now I understand that by all is literally meant all. An injury inflicted on others invariably comes back to haunt those doing the inflicting. It is not possible to tear at another's skin and not to have one's own humanity diminished in the process. To thus recoil at the venom spat against the Jews is to fear how that venom will end up and how I may be compelled to consume it one day. To defend the Palestinians against the daily humiliation by Jewish settlers and colonists is to defend the best in what the Jews have to offer the world. An injury to one is an injury to all. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.
Thank you very much. Alhamdulillah, lekker bij lekker. South Africa is not an Islamic country at all. There is a strong Muslim influence in the country. Muslims are 1.32% of the population. But because of the country's value of diversity, Muslims, Jews, and Hindus wield a disproportionate amount of influence in the country, both politically and culturally. Say, for example, the inauguration of the president starts on a Friday morning. Friday afternoon, the president would go and address a mosque. Sunday afternoon, the president would go to, Saturday afternoon, would go to a shul. And on Sunday, he would go to church. There are 20, 30,000 Jews in the country. There is no numeric reason why you should pay this attention to a minority. But there is just generally this value attached to the question of diversity in South Africa, which is wonderful. And so religious minorities play a disproportionate role to their numbers in South Africa.
Thanks for being succinct. There are a lot of questions coming in, so we will hopefully cover many of them. You mentioned South Africa's pro-Nazi stance. What about the pro-Nazi stance of so many Arabs and Palestinians during and after World War II? Do you condemn this as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would condemn all forms of Nazism, all forms of any kind of fundamentalisms. Nazism was just a more rabid kind of fundamentalism. Maybe one difference, though, and that is that the South African pro-Nazism translated itself into active support for the Nazis. South Africa, through its own formations, they sent soldiers to fight for Nazi Germany. The Turks may have wanted to enter into alliances with Nazi Germany. I don't think they actually sent soldiers to the front. South Africans itself organized on a huge scale the Ossewaarbrandwag, on a huge scale mobilized young people and so on to prepare South Africa for the coming of the Nazis and to undermine the British government at that time. So, yes, it wasn't just South African support for the Nazis. I think that there was lots of support for the Nazis in the Muslim world as well. Yes.
What led you to embrace Islam and become a Muslim?
I was struggling to find the words that I hear in the question. I embrace Islam every day. I did not embrace Islam on any particular day. I embrace Islam every day, sometimes with a firmer clasp, sometimes with a not so firm a class. Sometimes I see Islam and then I duck around that corner. I don't really want to see Islam. Sometimes I see Islam and I run, hey, you know. I embrace Islam every day. It is for me two things in Islam that draws me to it. Why am I in love with Islam? It is Allah and how I understand God in Islam, particularly the obsession that this Allah has with two things, the obsession that this ilah, that this God has with compassion and with justice. The Quran, yeah, for me, this God has a tremendous obsession with this. And so I love this God for this. I get scared of God for this. I want to dodge him sometimes. I sometimes can't live up to my own commitments to it, so I dodge this God sometimes. But it's also the Quran and the value that the Quran has for me in a non-cerebral way, in a deeply personal way, in the Quran as a chanted discourse, something which I can't really explain it. At a very deeply philosophical, spiritual level, these are the things that leads me to embrace Islam. If you were asking, when did I become a Muslim? I become a Muslim every day. I sometimes become not so good, sometimes better. If you ask me the normative sense of a religion, my family has always been Muslim.
Do you agree that Zionism is racism, or is it a form of nationalism, or both, or something else?
I think that any idea that is based on the accident of birth is a form of racism. Any idea that privileges some people over others because of birth, no matter how important this idea is, it is a form of racism. So if your entry into a particular religious group is because your mother belonged to that particular group, it is an idea that I can't live with. I know it's a difficult idea for many people because your identities revolve around it. But for me, from the outside, in the Quran, for example, Abraham pleads for his son. And God says, إِنَّهُ لَيْسَ مِنْ أَهْلِكَ. He is not your son. إِنَّهُ إِنْ عَمَلَهُ عَمَلًا غَيْرُ صَالِحٍ. That his deeds are unrighteous deeds. And so it is righteous deeds that determine kith and kin. Coming from South Africa, where biological accidents gave people certain privilege over other people, it's biological accidents. I mean, now, of course, for me, it's biological accidents. You can say it's God's divine plan for you and so on. I can understand that. I don't want to put it crudely, but if you ask me honestly and with friends and friends who may even disagree with you, I will say, yes, Zionism is racism. And I say this with the sensitivity that I can, because there are many of you who may be Zionists and who hate the idea of racism. And I can understand and appreciate this, and I can listen to you also.
Will you please talk about the Israeli invasion of Lebanon?
I don't really want to talk about the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, because partly what happens with these things, we focus from drama to drama. And then who's right in this drama? Who's wrong in this drama? I have an argument about this particular drama. And underneath all of this, you know, the ethical realities of occupation, the ethical realities or the trauma of the Holocaust, all of those are real and abiding things. So I often prefer to speak about those things and through those things, hopeful that people can make their own kind of connections and so on. The flattening of a whole country, the flattening of a whole country because two soldiers were arrested or captured or kidnapped in response to an earlier issue, and then that is how long ago should the... I don't know, the word that had been used, and I haven't been quite happy with it, is disproportionate. It's a word that may be used, but I don't know how the destruction of a whole, this collective punishment thing, and this is, how do you punish an entire nation for the kidnapping of two soldiers? I don't know. I don't understand this. And worse was the world then standing by and saying, no, fine, let's give them a week. Let's give them 10 days to finish as much of Lebanon as possible. And this was really what was happening. And then we'll sort it out. And then when the Israelis couldn't quite pull it off as successfully, after about 2 weeks or something like that, then they called for a ceasefire, because the Israelis could have gotten deeper into a mess. And clearly the Lebanese seem to have had a larger capacity both for resistance and to sacrifice lives. So the response of the whole world to it was said a lot about how power runs in the world. But again, it is more those power that we need to be critiquing, and our own role as citizens of the empire that we need to be reflecting on, I think, that may be a little bit more helpful than just debating the invasion of Lebanon or the bombing of Lebanon or the kidnapping of these two soldiers.
How do you maintain your sense of optimism?
I never think of myself as optimistic. I never think of myself as optimistic or of pessimistic. There is a hadith of the Prophet that I quote in one of my books there on being a Muslim, that if the day of judgment strikes and you are on your way to the field with a seed, you're going to plant the seed, and then the hour strikes, you know, it is judgment day, you finish planting your seed. You do your thing. This hour of judgment that is striking, this is God's business. Your business is to plant seeds. So that's the one. That's one story. There's another story that's very moving for me. We share the story with Christians, the story of Joseph. So Joseph was being sold on the slave as a market after he was dumped by his brothers, and then some elderly woman is seen going to the market. And she's asked, where is she going to? She has a bale of wool in her hand. Where is she? And she's saying that, oh, she had a dream that God's servant was being sold on the market, and that she is now going to make a bid to set him free. So they look at this woman, you in which army, you know, such an attractive slave, so expensive, high prices going, you and this bale of wool. And she said, on the day of judgment, let it not be said that I did not do what I could to free God's servant on the market. So for us, it's not, are we going to succeed or not? Excuse me. Are we going to bring about peace in Palestine and Israel or not? That's not the question for me, believe it or not. In all my years of engagement in the liberation struggle, I did not once believe that we would see victory in our lifetime. Not once. But the privilege of engagement in the struggle, our humanity was determined by our resisting. So that woman with her bale of wool would have been a lesser human being if she did not walk towards the market. She did not have the wherewithal to free Joseph. So I don't have an optimism in the sense of, oh, at the end of the day, something is going to change there. I'm optimistic that things will change there. I never think of optimism or pessimism. The moral imperative, the moral compulsion, I see suffering here. Can I lift the person up or not? I don't know. But I cannot walk past without trying. So I derive my legitimacy as a human being from this capacity, the capacity to act in the face of injustice, regardless of whether I will succeed or not. In this earlier evangelical group that I belonged to many years ago, we always said that effort is in your hands. Success is in the hands of God. So the outcomes, it's not something that particularly fascinates me.
I think there are many of us in this room that are really grateful for that response. Thank you so much. Thank you. Can you speak to the practicalities of applying anti-apartheid measures, for instance, boycott, to the Israeli-Palestinian issue?
The sanctions movement against South Africa was very, very effective. It was one of the most effective ways that brought the South African regime down. And the fear that the Israeli government have of sanctions is clearly reflective of its own effectiveness. And so I think that, yes, that the sanctions movement is an important one. I think that divestment campaigns are important ones. And it could be phrased in other terms. It could be phrased in responsible investment. And then you could also decide what part of Israeli sectors or Palestinian sectors you want to invest in. But this is part of what I think is the moral responsibility. It's, again, not whether it will work or not. Do I want my money to be involved in an economy that does this? This is the question. Are the people who are most likely to suffer under this, are they asking for it or not? Yes, they are asking for it. Other measures that are equally important are the solidarity visits, I mean, to Palestine and to Israel. It is the strengthening of a Palestinian constituency or a lobby in this country, connected to other lobbies, the anti-war movement, for example, the peace movement in the country. It must be connected to those things because the struggle for Palestine is one manifestation of a broader struggle against the empire. But the two most important things, I think, it is this international solidarity visits that people, especially people who carry United States passports and Canadian passports, that they go there, that they be exposed, because regardless of the toughness of the regime, they continue to have a sensitivity. But I also think that far more needs to be done to converse with local Jews about things. The United States Jewish community is an enormously influential Jewish community and sometimes far more conservative and right-wing than Jews in Israel. Far more conservative than Jews in Israel, partly, I think, to compensate for their own lack of courage to go there. It's like distant Catholics being more Catholics than Catholics in Rome. For different reasons, I think, but I think far more needs to be done to engage local, the local Jewish communities and the local Zionist communities. And to get them to see the connections between, I mean, how, you know, when George Bush is not getting anything right in your eyes, how can he just be getting this thing right? Yeah.
You briefly referred to the U.S.-Israel Free Trade Agreement of 1985 as having provided a way to market South African goods. What book or books would you recommend to read further about Israel's role in supporting apartheid South Africa?
Uri Davis, Israel as an Apartheid State. It's perhaps the most important book that deals with this. Uri Davis, Israel as an Apartheid State.
How would you respond to the statement by Chief Buthelezi that the Israeli regime is not apartheid, it is a unique case of democracy?
You know, one of the things that I find really curious, you have many really cool people, man, kind of into arts and theater, homes filled with books and so on. I'm talking about some of the middle-class Zionists, say, in a country like the United States. Enlightened, good conversationalists. And then the next moment, they kind of hang out with the Pat Robinson crowd or the Jimmy Swaggart crowd. How it doesn't...
The library's closing in a half hour.
I thought it was God intervening on behalf of Jimmy Swaggart. Hey, that guy, he is all-powerful, man. I don't even know what I'm trying to say. Sophisticated, urbanites, New York Times readers, New York Literary Review, da-da-da. And then the next moment, the guy's on the same platform as Pat Robertson. Not Pat Robertson, Jimmy Swaggart. In fact, Pat Robertson is quite anti-Israel. But with these other right-wing happy clappies, I think you know what I'm trying to say. So, happily invoking the most conservative, gay-hating, anti-women crowd, biblical fundamentalist, there's the only salvation through Christ via my church, and my church is not the name of a huge denomination, my church is this building, that I am the pastor of, and I'm the collector of all the funds in this church. That particular crowd... And so I put this question in the same kind of mold. Buthelezi, this arch-conservative, very traditionalist fellow, supporter of virginity testing for women, compulsory virginity testing for women, really an ancient remnant of earlier South African society, responsible for an enormous amount of this, what passes black-on-black violence, acquired his legitimacy in South Africa because the hold that he had over a large crowd was just too powerful, so we had to keep him, this kind of thing, better the guy having doing what he does inside the tent, standing inside the tent, doing it out, than outside the tent, doing it in. And Gacha comes up with this. It is part of... I think he has been cultivated for, I mean, a number of other black leaders in South Africa. Gacha was never really a part of the liberation struggle, so I'd be happy to just dismiss him like that. But a number of South African leaders, economic leaders mostly, were also co-opted, invited to Israel by the Israeli government and so on, and some of them were persuaded that this is a wonderful state. But during the apartheid years, we would bring people to the white government would bring people to South Africa also. And we show them all the nice things, a functional democracy and so on. And they go back feeling very impressed. I mean, Gacha is just one of those people. But mercifully for us, Gacha is a bit beyond his sell-by date. And so he's not playing any effective role in the country at the moment.
How would you characterize the situation of the Palestinian refugees in Palestine and elsewhere in the Levant in the paradigm of apartness?
Yes. This is one of the differences, of course, that we had. South Africa, we had people in exile, and exile is always a very painful condition. But our exiles were welcomed in the other parts of southern Africa. They were allowed to set up bases there, training bases and so on, which then facilitated the liberation of our country. In the Arab world, where the Palestinians have gone as refugees, the Palestinians on the whole were despised. And I'm not saying that the Arab states should have given them all the rights that they've given their own citizens, because the Arab states, I think, argued quite correctly that they should be going home. And if they become comfortable there, they would never get home. They argued quite correctly. I also think that the Arab states themselves were actively discouraged from providing more humanitarian, decent aid to the Palestinians that were living inside their own countries. I think in many ways the South Africa's frontline states were far freer from the interferences of imperialism than what the frontline states in the Arab world are. So we had Mozambique, for example, we had Tanzania, we had Angola, we had Southwest Africa, we had Rhodesia, or later becoming Zimbabwe, and Zambia above that. And all of those countries were engaged in active struggles for their own liberation. And so South African exiles were much more at home. In the Arab countries around Palestine, the desperation is to get buy-in into the empire, not to free themselves from the empire. And so this means then that the Palestinian refugees have a double kind of agony, the agony of exile, which is not mitigated in any way by a kind of acceptance and a natural water wherein you find yourself as South African exiles found themselves in.
Let's make this the last question, because we're being interrupted more and more by, we're about to close announcements from the library, and we probably should be out of here by 9 or shortly after. Would a socialist economy have a greater effect than capitalism in reducing the friction between people?
It's a loaded question. Look, people, I don't want to answer that question in a direct way. But I'll tell you in an indirect way. People think that South Africa is free. I can tell you, we are only free to make our country. That is what we are free to do. After the end of apartheid, we have seen how our country in all this time had really become a municipality of the larger market forces. We have seen how our country is constrained to really doing things about poverty alleviation, about providing free water, free medical care, and so on to our people. We have seen how the disparities between poor and rich has increased. But the world isn't interested in that. We only want to see black and white together and then we're happy. This very simplistic view of what reconciliation is. You know, no matter... And so we see a black guy, very, very wealthy, walking over another black body. Oh, and it's okay, these black dudes are doing it to each other. It happens in the townships all the time, isn't it? That's how blacks are. So I am saying that the international market economy has done nothing for our country. It has limited the ability of an initially left-leaning government to really move on issues of economic justice for our people. I, for one, certainly from what I've seen in the world, from what I've seen in South Africa, I think that the free market system is an incorrigible one, that it cannot be saved. I think that there is a desperate need for people to begin to think of alternatives, both for the sake of human beings, for the sake of what life is about. I mean, if you look at the patenting of seeds, the patenting of human life, for what human life is about, and for the future of our environment, an economic system that can only thrive on new developments and new money and growth. If you are committed to growth, an endless growth, you are in a mess. Because the cold reality is this, that we are finite human beings and that the earth is finite. We have one home, only one home. And so for the sake of our lives, our humanity, for the sake of our homes, it's only the crazies who will adhere to this market economy and say there is no other way. For us who are believers especially, there has to be another way.